And good morning, listeners. We are back with another Riddles in the Dark podcast. We apologize for the approximately 24-hour delay, but Professor Olson obviously takes his university duties very seriously and had to wrap up grading for the spring semester.
So that's right.
Yeah, we let you get that out of the way before we distracted you with speculation about The Hobbit.
Yeah, but, so I was sitting there grading papers, but unfortunately did not happen to jot down in any one of them the line of a new novel.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
But we're finally, no more of that nonsense. We're done grading. Now we're getting down to the real important stuff. What's going to happen in The Hobbit? So
exactly.
Let's get started. Welcome to another Riddles in the Dark podcast. I'm your co-host, Dave Kale, and with me, as always, is the Tolkien professor, Corey Olson. So I believe you had a topic you wanted to
a
teachable moment you wanted to start with.
Yes, one kind of irrelevant but sort of nagging thing that has come up a couple of times. There have been several people who have posted on my Tolkien Professor Facebook page or sent me an email about this, and I keep meaning to get around to it, and I keep forgetting. So I'm going to finally get around to it today. And that is, people have been asking about the pronunciation of the dwarves' names. And basically, you know, that is, many people have noticed, for instance, how I keep saying Thrain as the father of Thorin, you know, Thror, Thrain, and Thorin, of course. And the reason that I do this, I think that it is fairly clear that it's supposed to be two syllables. So that's, and I would emphasize that my authority for this is not any kind of expertise in Icelandic. Of course, the names of the dwarves all come from the poetic Edda. So, but it's not in that. I actually, I have no expertise in Old Norse, but what I do have is Tolkien's own notations on this, which you can see if you go to Appendix A in The Return of the King and look in particular at the genealogy there. You find that he consistently puts accent marks over the A's and O's in the dwarf's name. I say consistently. Actually, it's not quite consistent. But anyway, you can see that he puts those accent marks there. And Tolkien uses those accent marks to indicate when things are supposed to be different syllables like that. So those are pronunciation guides primarily. So when you have somebody whose name is D-A-I-N with an accent over the A, he's doing that to indicate that you're supposed to pronounce that as two syllables. It's not just Dane or Dine. It's two syllables. It's Dayan. And similarly, G-L-O-I-N is not Gloin. It's Glowin. And so that's the primary thing. You can also see when Tolkien puts an umlaut, puts the two dots above a terminal E. Again, he's doing that in order to give you a cue for pronunciation. So, when you have an E at the end, which is supposed to be pronounced, which is not a silent E, he will tend to put those two dots there to indicate this gets a syllable. It's not silent. So anyway, so that's the main thing. It's clear that he meant those to be two syllable words. So it's not Thrain and Dane or Dine and Thrine. It's Thrain and Dayan. So that's the simplest thing. The other, sort of more indirect, but kind of cuter piece of evidence that we have for this, I was not present at this event, but at a big Tolkien Society conference several years ago, Michael Tolkien attended the event and gave a talk in which he was recalling J.R.R. Tolkien's readings of The Hobbit to them and the sort of games and jokes that they used to make. And he talked about this sort of fake story that they had made up, which they had made up manifestly in imitation of The Hobbit as a kind of, like, you know, in-house parody of The Hobbit. And the names that they the fake names that they made up for the dwarves and things were all things which were clearly designed to rhyme with the real dwarf names, but they were real words like throw in, throw-in, and throw in and stay in and things like that. So again, by itself, that sort of shows clearly how they were pronouncing them among themselves if they thought if they thought the phrase throw-in was sort of a silly imitation of the name Glowin. It shows you how they were pronouncing Glowin, doesn't it? So anyway, so that's the other sort of anecdotal evidence for how those names would have been pronounced. So anyway, so that's how I always do the dwarf names. It is it's on a fairly simple basis, and sometimes I slip up. I mean, I am inconsistent in my own pronunciation, especially I find Thrain harder to be consistent about, and I sometimes slip into Thrain, which is how I used to pronounce it when I was little. But anyway.
That's sort of an unnatural sound for
native
born Americans.
It is a little bit more awkward. Glowin is easy enough, I think. But yeah, some of the other ones are a little bit more awkward. And Dian too. Dian. See, I just did it right now while talking about the pronunciation. Dian is really also sometimes a little bit counterintuitive too. So anyway, I just wanted to explain that is my answer to the dwarf name pronunciation question, which I know has been bothering several people.
Well, thank you for that clarification. That helps me, since I have about 8 different ways that I pronounce Thrain's name.
Yes.
And I never do it the same way twice.
Well, see, that's actually a fine approach, because then you know that you'll probably be right a certain percentage of the time.
That's right.
Whereas if you're consistently wrong, then you're wrong 100% of the time.
That's a good point. That's a good point. I'm spreading out. I'm doing a variety of different bets.
Exactly. Exactly.
Let's do a little bit of listener feedback from the Mythgard website. let's see. So, one thing that Faerund mentioned on our episode 6 and 7 post regarding the split and the White Council storyline is he had an interesting notion of how Sauron might be involved in the Battle of Five Armies, which I know in general people are pretty nervous about and don't really are dearly hoping that he doesn't show up in a giant suit of armor and start swinging his mace and making hundreds of people fly around like he did at the at the beginning of the Fellowship of the Ring. But he mentions this idea that for one thing, he says he thinks it's interesting, maybe Peter Jackson will tweak the storyline a little bit, make it to where the Necromancer is fully prepared for the White Council's assault, but it's the destruction of Smaug that causes him to flee, because that sort of changes the balance of power in the North and changes his calculations, and that's why he'll leave Dol Guldur. So that could maybe mean pushing the Dol Guldur battle later into the timeline. And he also points out that maybe when Sauron shows up at the Battle of Five Armies, he's not going to be there fighting physically, but rather he'll be there sort of as a presence. So Faerun mentions, Gandalf thinks Sauron may have won the battle after all, the Necromancer flees, Gandalf's like, I think we didn't actually win that, guys. I'd better get over to the Lonely Mountain. And what he finds is Sauron's there, but sort of is kind of in his weakened spirit mode. And he's not actually fighting, but maybe he's sort of influencing people, causing them to behave badly, particularly if the dwarf ring is playing a role. Maybe he's whispering in people's ears and making them distrust each other and stuff like that.
It's a really interesting possibility. I mean, here's the bigger question that lies behind that possibility. And that is, how are they going to depict? Are they going to try to depict like a minor league Sauron? I mean, because of course, one of the whole reasons for making Sauron a flaming eyeball in the first place is, how do you represent on film the idea that Sauron is, you know, sort of this spiritual presence which, you know, has a wide radius of influence? I mean, it's hard to show that kind of completely invisible spiritual influence over people. I mean, that's also why we ended up with the elaborate exorcism scene with Théoden, for the same reason, because it's really hard to depict the kind of control that Saruman had via Wormtongue over Théoden, without giving some kind of a visual representation. And the exorcism was clearly a way to render that visual and therefore dramatic on screen. Basically, what are they going to make what are they going to make Sauron look like? I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that he's not going to be in the same outfit, right, such that anybody who was there at the Battle of the Last Alliance or has heard about it would be like, oh, it's Sauron! I recognize the spooky helmet! Right? I mean, like, so obviously he needn't look exactly the same, But how is he going to look? Is he going to look human? Are we actually going to see him? Is he going to be cloaked or something? Are we going to get like a kind of like, you know, Emperor Palpatine thing going on with him? Exactly how are they going to do that? And if they do that, how would they do that kind of influence? Because again, that's notoriously difficult to do on screen. I mean, I genuinely, here I am kind of, speaking as I am wont to do, with a certain amount of flippancy about the way that they represented these things on film. But it's a genuine challenge. I don't know how I would do it if I were making a film, to depict that, the kinds of influence, the way that magic and the exertion of power over others, especially dominion, is actually described in Tolkien's world. It's really hard to do. So I don't know. I mean, I think,
So do we get any hints about his appearance here? Because what we know for sure is that post downfall of Numenor, he cannot take on a fair pleasing shape. So I'm guessing we're not going to see Benedict Cumberbatch without much makeup on. He's far too pleasing a sight.
Right.
So that's out. But also, you know, my understanding is that after the battle of after he's struck down by Isildur, he never really even takes on a sort of concrete physical humanoid shape from then on. He's mostly dark spirit, and then by the time he gets back to Mordor, he's now a giant flaming eyeball, or rather, whether literally or figuratively, a giant flaming eyeball.
Yeah, I mean, it is very unclear. It is very unclear what Sauron looks like. If you were to actually to go before him in the Barad-dûr, what does he look like? I think he does have some kind of physical, presence. And actually the closest we get to this is Pippin's conversation with him in the Palantir. And the sense that Pippin gives is that it's actually a person that he's looking at. You know, then he looked at me, he says. It does seem that he has some kind of physical form. But we never see it. I mean, other than that brief near encounter in the Palantir, that secondhand encounter that we get in the Palantir, just Pippin's description, we don't really know, what he looks like. But yes, he's not able to put on a fair appearance to deceive people anymore. But presumably he can put on a kind of, tyrant's appearance, and not just a flaming eyeball appearance. And I'm joking about this, but of course I do want to emphasize he never appears as a flaming eyeball, in the books. But anyhow, this is even unclear, you know, for instance, in the passages which describe Gandalf going, I mean, when, of course, Gandalf, when he goes to Dol Guldur, in the books, or when we hear about this, we don't ever get a full narration of Gandalf's trip into Dol Guldur, of course, but one of the things that he's doing is confirming who is this necromancer guy, you know, is it, and their main question seems to be, is it Sauron taking shape again, or is this one of the Ringwraiths? Is it, because it could be just like the Witch King. You know, the Witch King left Angmar and hasn't been really, you know, definitively heard from since. And since he's not locked up in a tomb, he could be the one. He could be the necromancer. And so somehow Gandalf goes in and confirms that it's Sauron, so that when he comes back, he's able to say, yeah, I've like 100% certain ID'd the dude. It's Sauron. But see, the thing is that it's very uncertain exactly what that means. Like, does he identify him by sight? I mean, does he actually get to like Sauron's, you know, the necromancer's, I don't know would he have a throne room, his hall or whatever? I don't know. And, you know, see him? And I mean, would he have to see him? Could he just get close enough to sort of feel his presence in some sense. I don't know. But I mean, all that we do know is that Gandalf is able to confirm positively it's definitely Sauron after he goes to Dol Guldur. So yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I would emphasize here is that this is wide open. I mean, for Peter Jackson, this whole area is wide open. Sauron's depiction, his physical depiction here is wide open. Because we don't know. It could well be. I could see Sauron just being a literally shadowy figure. Maybe cloaked like a ringwraith. Maybe just a voice in the darkness. I could see anything like that. Anything like that would fit, I think, perfectly fine. He could even have a physical form and be wearing a mask or a different helmet or something like that. I don't know. But it is very interesting. I mean, and this seems kind of like a digression, I think, but it does bear directly on this, that is on this question that our listener was raising, because if he's going to appear either in the Battle of Dol Guldur or appear at the Battle of Five Armies directly or indirectly, how's that going to go? Now, you think, though, here's my thought about the Battle of Five Armies question, though, the specific issue with the Battle of Five Armies, is that basically Smaug's already dead. I mean, Smaug was what he was invested in. And obviously, he would rather have the goblins win the Battle of Five Armies. You know, that would be in his interest to stamp out the dwarves. If he could stamp out the dwarves, humans, and elves up in that region in one big battle, that would be pretty awesome. So you could see how he would, in fact, have a stake in the Battle of Five Armies, even after Smaug is dead. But to some extent, the damage is done when Smaug is dead. So if Sauron were to have a, like, oh, crap, I'd better help out up north moment, you'd think it would be prior to this. But I don't know. I mean, I guess you could see, like, he hears about Smaug's death and it's like, oh crap, the whole north is falling. Let's see if anything can be salvaged out of that situation. But that strikes me as a little anticlimactic, I have to say, for Sauron in the south. Having him do a kind of, like, I don't know, rear guard action or sort of desperate attempt to salvage operations, up north when Smaug is already dead. I don't know. I'm not enormously convinced by that.
Yeah, they would have to do that very carefully so it didn't seem nonsensical and forced. You know, it didn't look like they were just trying to cram every major character into every battle and every scene.
Right. Right. Yeah.
I think that people are prepared to accept this apocryphal material in the film, mm-hmm. and even prepared to accept a little bit of innovation and some changes and stuff. And I think we all sort of buy the notion that the necromancer is connected to Smaug. You know, Tolkien talked about this in some of his extra material, but it's not that strong of a connection. You know, at least
right.
Tolkien didn't set it up that way. He set it up sort of very tenuously he sort of set up the possibility of a connection had events not unfolded the way they did.
Right.
So
right.
I think they need to be very careful not to overdo it.
Right. Exactly. Because, you know, to some extent, if they do overdo that, then we could be getting a sort of secondhand version of the horrible image you made last time of the Witch King riding Smaug. That is Smaug. You know, Smaug is a free agent. You know,
yes.
I mean, yes, Sauron could work with him, and the two of them, you know, could certainly benefit. And maybe Sauron could just pull rank and say, "You're working for me now, buddy." But I mean, that's not guaranteed. That's not absolute. Any more than the Balrog would be. I mean, you know, the Balrog and Smaug, either one of them, could basically say, you know, forget you, Sauron. I'm setting up on my own. You're not the boss of me, because he wasn't the boss of them.
Right.
So that's kind of unclear. And basically, I think it's gonna make the reason I find, of course, the idea of a ringwraith flying on Smaug so horrifying, is that it completely downgrades Smaug. Smaug, Smaug is then just a minor accessory of the villain, rather than being really the central force that that I think he really should be. And, right. and I would hate to see him pushed into the margins like that, even, you know, sort of halfway, which I think it would be if there were any sense that Smaug were, you know, reporting to Sauron in any sense, if he's just an agent.
Saruman.
Yeah, exactly.
I personally felt that – I felt the same way about Saruman. I felt he was completely I did not like Saruman as Sauron's bewitched stooge.
Yes.
I always preferred the book's take where it's somebody sort of playing both sides.
Yes, exactly. That he is in rivalry of Mordor and not yet in its service. Yeah, exactly. No, I agree. The thing which I think – the one moment which undermines Saruman more than any other in the films is the "build me an army worthy of Mordor," and so that basically
he
everything
come up with that idea on his own,
right? Exactly.
Oh, obviously an army.
Right. I got a great idea. But, I mean, yeah, it's just it's the idea that he's just like saluting to Sauron and saying yes, sir, whatever you say, sir, does really change things, and I would hate to see Smaug doing that as well. So no, I mean, it would be the whole idea of a relationship. I mean, it certainly is a logical relationship, and there doesn't seem much reason to think that Smaug and Sauron wouldn't work together, at least in the short term, because, you know, obviously they would both benefit. In particular, of course, because you remember the particular thing that Gandalf said he would have been afraid of is that while Sauron was occupying people with his armies in the south, that Smaug could have been sent around to the north and could have attacked Rivendell. So that, you know, that Rivendell could have been destroyed by Smaug from behind, mm-hmm. while Sauron was occupying everybody else down in the south, and, you know, neither Gandalf nor Galadriel nor anybody else could have come to Elrond's
right.
assistance.
And that even if they had destroyed the ring, defeated Sauron, that they would have returned to the north to find the whole thing just charred remains.
Right, exactly. Again, would Smaug have agreed to do that? I think Gandalf is quite right to fear that, obviously. I mean, that seems like a perfectly sensible thing, because of course Smaug would have a lot to benefit. I mean, would he like to – Rivendell is where most of the high elves remaining in Middle Earth are, which means like most of the cool swag remaining in Middle Earth from the First Age is there, you know? Mm-hmm. So I just think how he could increase his hoard, if he were to take Rivendell. So would he want to do that? Oh yeah, sure he would want to do that. And it would benefit Sauron. But again, to have the two of them communicating and coordinating during the films, I think would be bad, because mm-hmm. it would demote one of them or the other. If we see Smaug taking orders, that reduces him. If we see the two of them cooperating as equals, it reduces Sauron. I mean, it's harder to take Sauron as seriously as the Dark Lord behind all of the evil. If we see, you know, him and the dragon being like, okay, I'll take this side, you take that side, let's go. Mm-hmm. It's harder. But see, again, I'm hoping that they don't. I really hope that they don't depict Sauron much at all. The fact that he's cast makes me nervous enough to start with. I think it would be very easy for him to get into like Lord Voldemort material.
Yeah, he's on screen so much, he's totally diminished.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think they're better off. I think they're better off not putting him on screen too much. And also, yeah, I prefer that they take this sort of, you know, do the same thing with Smaug and Sauron that they do in the book, which is just make it sort of a tantalizing hint of things that might have been, and don't try to actually do it too much.
Right.
This is one of those things that frequently ends up being far less interesting in execution than it is in theory.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the less, cause I mean, you can easily have people in the White Council talking about it, you know, to make sure that the audience is appropriately afraid, you know, to make sure that they are thinking, oh my goodness, like imagine what could happen. This could be terrible, but we certainly don't need you know, the other side of that table, you know, and to have, you know, like Sauron and Smaug, like, on their cell phones or whatever to each other, you know, coordinating their own efforts. Just the idea of having these two threats. You know, we have, you know, the one part of the film, which is building up the threat of Dol Guldur, and the other part of the film, which is getting closer and closer to the better known threat of Smaug. You know, and then you just throw out there the possibility that they could work together. You know, like what could happen if they actually combine forces. And I think, you know, I really don't think you need to do more than that.
Yep, I completely agree. We should probably move on to a new topic.
Yes, we should probably move on to our actual topic today. Yeah.
No, but briefly, I do have one other.
We have another one. Okay, let us continue putting off our main topic.
And we'll see if we can actually spend like 2 minutes on this. Michael Lucero on our most recent episode commented, and he, by the way, Michael has an awesome Tumblr that is stoneofthehapless.tumblr.com. People should check out.
Oh, that is awesome.
Yeah, I thought you'd like that.
Super bonus points for the name of his Tumblr account.
That's right. He's offended by the notion that men could seal the Nazgul in the tomb using magic.
Well, you know, yeah. I mean, I see that. Yeah. Well, not sure what to say about that.
You feel the same way.
Seems like
it might be a necessary evil for the film.
Yeah, I feel. I mean, I will say nothing other than I can see how that would work on film. You know, I can see it functioning as a, like, you know, the Dark Menace unleashed moment. I can see it as a, to simplify things, because, you know, as I've said before, one of the thing about Tolkien's actual situation that he described is it's so indefinite. I mean, you're going to ask a film audience to basically accept what have they been doing for the last, you know, couple thousand years? Not much, you know, hanging out, laying the foundations in some sense that we don't understand for Sauron's return. You know, I mean, I get doing some like Sauron evangelism work over in the East among the Easterlings. I mean, there's stuff that they could be doing, but again, it's so much simpler and it's so much straightforward to be able to show, a film audience, here are the tombs where they have been sealed, showing that there was a time in the past when the good guys won and when evil was locked away and now evil is being opened up again. I mean, it's much more simplistic than the way that Tolkien describes it. But, you know, in part for that reason, I can see it working well on film. So, I mean, I'm not saying I would have done it this way. And I totally sympathize with the idea. I mean, the kind of magic involved, I mean, everything about it is really a fairly significant departure from the story that Tolkien told and the world that he created as far as that stuff goes. So no arguments there. But, you know, when I think about it, I can see it functioning on film and I'm not shocked that they went in that direction if that is indeed what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right.
So see how open-minded I am endeavoring to be as we approach the films. And I want to emphasize, this is the kind of open mind that I try to advocate to keep. Like, yes, it is a major departure. Yes, it misses the point of a bunch of different things in Tolkien's works, but this is their story. They can do this if they want, and I can imagine it working well as a story. That's the stuff that bothers me more than anything else, when they do stuff which undermines the story that even they are trying to tell. Like, this is why the things I have the hardest time forgiving them for in The Lord of the Rings are things like making Treebeard an idiot. Like, that really bothers me. You know, when Treebeard is like, oh, they're destroying my forest and I had no idea. I mean, like, that drives me bananas every time I see that part of the Two Towers. That's just like incoherent and frustrating. But you know, like other places where they, you know, have made changes which you know, which actually work internally. And again, here, the elves showing up at Helm's Deep is like the classic example I would give. Is it kind of silly? I mean, if you're thinking about Tolkien's story and stuff, is it kind of silly? Yeah, but you know, it works in the film. It works fantastically. It's really cool, actually, in the movie. So, you know, does it like, you know, offend my purism? Yes, it does. But I can totally live with it in the film. It's fine. Can I live with the Rohirrim fighting elephants? You know, absolutely. Yeah. You know, can I live with Legolas surfing? Sure. No problems. But yeah, it's when their own story really doesn't make
sense. Undermined by the things that they're doing.
Yeah. That's what really or when they just do things which seem to me, you know, from where I'm sitting to be totally unnecessary. But anyway.
Yep. Okay. Well, let's get on to the, theoretically the main topic of this.
Right. Let us now finally begin to talk about what we plan to talk about. And what we're talking about today is the frame narrative. So we've been kind of dancing around this for a while. We've mentioned it several times. But we wanted to come back and talk a little bit with more focus on the question of the frame story. And by the frame story, of course, we mean the Bilbo and Frodo, you know, the, what we can call the Elijah Wood element, of the Hobbit film. Those times which are going to be held in the future, though again, chronologically, it's already interesting, right? Because it has to take place, based on what we've seen in the trailer, it has to take place during the time before the long expected party. So it's chronologically prior to the entire Lord of the Rings story, but far after the Hobbit story. So that means they seem to be adopting a frame, because, you know, it's theoretically possible that it could be otherwise. It's theoretically possible that it could be like in Rivendell, or something like that, you know, after the Lord of the Rings story, but it's clearly not. It's clearly while the two of them, Bilbo and Frodo, are living together in Bag End prior to the beginning of the Lord of the Ring. I mean, am I right about that? I mean, that seems obvious from the trailer, right?
Yes, I would agree with that.
Yeah. So, okay. So what that means then is we have a story where that is the baseline. That's the chronological baseline of the story. So there are several factors that are therefore involved. And it raises therefore many questions. What about the ring? How do they do the ring? Of course, in this time, in the book stories, Bilbo doesn't really have any suspicion that the ring is anything malicious or anything more serious than a magical invisibility ring, which is very useful and which he's very fond of. And neither does anybody else, like Gandalf. How are they going to handle that? And this, of course, is a much bigger question, which we need to have an entire episode on, and we will before too long, and that is, how are they going to handle the ring and the wearing of the ring in the movie? But anyway, so leaving that aside for now, because that's a show unto itself, we have this framework and Bilbo telling Frodo the story of the Hobbit. So what is going to be Bilbo's frame of mind towards it? The one clear hint that we get towards this is that Ian Holm line from the trailer, right? When old Bilbo is like, you know, I forget the exact words. And he's like, you know, you haven't heard the whole story or something like that, where he's like indicating to him that there's, you know, that there's more that he needs to tell him. And this, to me, raises the really fascinating question of are we going to get any play on the unreliability of Bilbo as a narrator? Because, of course, a big part of Tolkien's story, necessitated by his own revisions of his story, is the fact that when Bilbo originally told the story to Frodo and to Gandalf and to the dwarves, he lied about it. That he never told the dwarves, until the Council of Elrond, he never told the dwarves the real story about how he got the ring, and what actually happened with Gollum. And that he put the wrong story down in his book. In other words, Bilbo is an unreliable narrator. He doesn't tell the true story. He lies about it. Now, the only part that he is said to lie about is chapter 5. That is the Riddles in the Dark chapter, the story of how he got the ring. But are we going to get any element of that? Are we going to get any hint of the fact that Bilbo is unreliable? Is there going to be tension here? Is that what the trailer is indicating when, Bilbo says that, you know, that he's going to tell him the real story? In the Fellowship of the Ring, of course, when Gandalf asks Frodo in chapter 2, if Bilbo told him the story, and Frodo says, yes, of course. And then Gandalf says, which story, I wonder? And, Frodo then says, oh, if you mean like what he wrote in his book and what he told the dwarves, no, he told me the real story some time ago. So is that exactly what we're talking about here?
That's an interesting point. I'm wondering, I have this suspicion that line that you mentioned where Bilbo says, you know, I told you the truth, but I didn't tell you the whole story, basically. Yeah. I have a suspicion that's a reference to this, but it's hard to imagine them returning to it throughout the film, because I feel like that would distract the unread audience, the people who are mostly fans of the film, haven't, you know, read through The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, and then really, really dug into this idea that The Hobbit, as you read it, is actually the story as Bilbo told it before he corrected himself during the Council of Elrond. And so I wonder if, I wonder if they're just going to say that once and then just play the story, and that it's really not going to actually play a role, and there's not going to be hints at different versions of the story.
Yeah, and 'cause see, I mean, the bigger question is, what kind of a role is the frame narrative going to take? Is it just an introductory gambit on their part? I could see several different versions of this. I could see one version, the minimalist version, where you contextualize it as a story, right, in order to establish, you use it merely as a link to connect this story to the Lord of the Rings films. And you do that through Bilbo and Frodo in Bag End, so that the film viewers have reasons to make that connection and to contextualize it. So basically just as a way to communicate to the filmgoers, hey, here is a story from something that happened before The Lord of the Rings, and that's it. And then you leave it behind, and we never see Ian Holm again, or Elijah Wood. That would be one option. Another, you know, way of doing it, there's like a middle ground way of doing it, so, you know, not quite so minimally as that, but also not very fully and not very intrusively either. That is, you could do like the beginning and the end, or even to sort of go back to them at important break times, like at the end of the film or the beginning of the second film or something like that. So, you know, maybe we have them at the beginning of the first film, at the beginning of the second film, and the end of the second film or something like that. That would be a step up from the totally minimalist version, but it would still be reducing the emphasis on it, so that really you're just watching that, you know, you're permitted to just get lost completely in the Hobbit story itself, with only kind of top and tail reminders of the fact that it's a story that you're hearing. The third version, the more thorough version, would be for them to be playing with the frame story much more intricately, playing with things like the unreliable narrator. Coming back to it, you know, like, and I've made this comparison before, but like The Princess Bride, you know, I mean, The Princess Bride does this very, very well. And I'm not suggesting they would do it in the same way, that they do in The Princess Bride, when we're reminded that this is a story being told and that there is an external audience, to the story itself. Mm-hmm. I could imagine that being done in some really interesting ways. And of course, like, if I were doing it, I would be totally tempted to do that, because I really love that kind of frame narrative. And I think that it's a really cool kind of tribute to the way that Tolkien was very thoughtful about his own frame narratives and about the writers of his stories. As, of course, Tolkien, the way that he would do this would not be as, I think, as a kind of oral narration like that of Bilbo telling Frodo a story. Instead, the frame claim that he would make is it would be a found manuscript, right? Here is a new manuscript that has lately been discovered. And we can trace its manuscript history back and show that this is a different version of the story. Like, that's totally how Tolkien would do it if he were doing a similar thing. So anyway, I could totally see that. And you could play, you know, in that framework, you could play with the, you could totally play with the unreliable narrator thing and even like different versions of a story. You could have one version of the Gollum story told and then, you know, go back and then like have Ian Holm called on it and go back and do another one. I mean, there are a bunch of different ways that you could play with it, and have it, basically.
Yeah, that would be fascinating. Doing retelling the same scene multiple times. I'm sure they won't do that. That'll come across as too goofy, but that would be very entertaining.
It could be done in some ways to actually create a certain kind of mystery, like you'd have to be avoiding confusion, but anyway, it could be done really cool, but I don't think they're going to do that.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned the found manuscript idea. That would be a really interesting way to take on this, given the recent spate of found footage, low budget films that people have been making.
Right. Yes. Yeah. No, exactly.
Well, we found this recording of what really happened to Bilbo.
Right. Yes. Yes. Wouldn't you know? It was in the Great Smiles archives all along.
The people in the chat room brought up a really good point. All the White Council sort of peripheral material. How does that? If what we're getting in the film is not going to be, if what we're getting in the film is indeed Bilbo recounting the story and recounting the true story to Frodo, if we're going to stick with the frame narrative, how are they going to work in all the stuff that's happening sort of that basically the parts of the story that Bilbo's not involved in?
It's a fantastic question, because of course that's exactly why that stuff is not there in the books.
Yes.
Because Tolkien is consistent with that. You know, he's consistent with the frame of his narrative by and large. And now, the thing that I would clarify, of course, The Hobbit is not narrated by Bilbo himself. The published Hobbit is not, we know that The Hobbit was in origin Bilbo's private diary. But it never is Bilbo's private diary. That is, even the first edition published version doesn't ever claim to be a first person account.
True.
We do get this glimpse of it. We know that that's where it comes from. We see Bilbo writing his memoirs, which he calls There and Back Again, A Hobbit's Holiday, in the last chapter of the book. That is of the published Hobbit. But it's never that. The narrator of The Hobbit is, the narrator who actually addresses the reader is a modern figure. This is why you get all these things which sometimes bother people, the things that look like anachronisms in The Hobbit, the references to express trains and Christmas trees and things like that. Because they're not actually anachronisms. They are the modern narrator addressing his modern audience and making comparisons to modern things in order to illustrate the story that he's telling. Mm-hmm. So even in the first edition, the idea is, the seeds of the idea are already there, that Bilbo comes home from his journey, he writes his memoirs down, but those memoirs that he writes get retold and reset by later people, so that the text that actually is come before us is not Bilbo's diary, but a modern rendition, modern redaction of Bilbo's diaries.
Yeah.
And Tolkien himself casts himself as narrator in the dwarf runes on the inside cover, of the original publication of The Hobbit. He mentions himself by name as being the editor of the manuscript, of being the guy who has done the redactions from Bilbo's journal. So we can already see that he doesn't immediately invent the extensive Middle Earth textual history that we get in the prologue to the Fellowship of the Ring. That is, you know, like Bilbo's diary was incorporated into the Red Book of Westmarch, which was then recopied and brought down to Gondor and recopied again, and all these other things. He hadn't invented any of that, of course, in 1937, but we can already see the beginnings of that.
Right.
Later on. So, but anyway, this is all as much as to say there was not a mechanism. And that's why the only time we get glimpses of what went on with the White Council people is when Gandalf's talking, or when we get like that overheard, the Appendix A overheard conversation, which gets excerpted and put into the Quest of Erebor between Gandalf and Frodo and Gimli. So where we're getting the wizard side of it, we get a glimpse of it in the essay on the Rings of Power in the Third Age, published at the end of the Silmarillion. You know, where we get things like Gandalf coming back to Elrond after his trip to Dol Guldur and saying the two of them by themselves, yeah, I was right. It's Sauron. So basically, yes, this is an interesting problem. Now, of course, one way to solve this problem as a frame narrative, would be to have Gandalf there, to bring Gandalf into it. Which
have Gandalf sitting next to Bilbo and Frodo saying, yeah, and I'll fill in the gaps for you.
Right, exactly. to make that into a three-way conversation. Or to even, you know, you could even do it to, you know, it could be done, I guess the simplest way it could be done is, you know, Bilbo saying to Frodo, yeah, like, Gandalf later filled me in on, like, all the other stuff that was really happening during all of this. So I'll tell you the full story, not just like the bit that you read in my diary, which would contain his own personal account, presumably. Yeah. 'Cause we know that he wrote that. We see Bilbo writing his diary, in the opening sequence. Well, not the very opening sequence, but in the Concerning Hobbits sequence, of the Lord of the Rings film.
But doesn't this open up the possibility, as Trish points out in the chat room, that Frodo would know too much? I mean, there's a lot of things that he learns at the very start of the Lord of the Rings story that are things that if he had been told the entire story of what was happening while Bilbo was on this adventure, including the White Council stuff and the necromancers actually Sauron, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
In some sense, that obviates the need for the whole frame story for the Quest of Erebor thing, where mm-hmm. you know, in the Book of Unfinished Tales and stuff, where Gandalf goes back and says, "Let me explain to you how this fits into the larger story." If Gandalf's telling Frodo all of this at the same time that Bilbo's recounting his story, then Frodo already knows everything, and
right,
he certainly
prior to
doesn't.
Lord of the Rings, yeah. 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 Well, I mean, okay. It would introduce a potential continuity error or a potential continuity problem between the Hobbit film and the Lord of the Rings films. But, you know, I'm not sure how big of a continuity problem it creates. That is, I don't think there is any particular piece of information which Frodo is supposed to not have, which if he gets in the Hobbit creates a continuity problem. I mean, for instance, when Gandalf mentions Mordor and mentions Sauron, it seems clear even in the film that Frodo's heard of them. You know, I mean, that it's not like he's never heard the name in his life before, or never heard of such a thing. That would be a continuity problem. I mean, if in the Lord of the Rings we had, like, let me tell you, once upon a time there was a dude named Sauron. If that happened in the Lord of the Rings films, then clearly we couldn't have anything like that in The Hobbit without creating a big problem. But instead, it seems to me that the only real continuity issue there, though I agree that there is one potentially, but it's just like the level of his cluelessness and his naivete. Like, basically, he would be slightly less naive, if he had already heard the whole story of, the whatever happens with Dol Guldur, and Sauron's return, that then if it were totally continuous, what should be happening when Gandalf in the beginning of the Fellowship of the Ring says, talks about Sauron of Mordor, then Frodo should be like, you know, like, no, the time has come, has it? Like, you know, we knew that he was building towards this. You know, and obviously he's not that savvy in the films. But again, does he actually say anything? Is his ignorance of certain information necessary to the plot of the Fellowship of the Ring? I don't recall anything, that would be that kind of a particular problem. Though again, attitude-wise, it would be a little hard to see Frodo being quite as sort of fresh and clueless, as he seems to be. Though, I guess, you know, at the same time, you could combat that in a sense just by the way you depict Frodo in the Hobbit frame. I mean, you know, he does not have to take this stuff terrifically seriously, I guess, if that makes any sense.
Yeah,
I mean, basically, if you show him having a kind of immature response to it and being like, wow, cool. Anyway, I gotta go. Yeah, like, so that basically it doesn't really hit home to him until the Fellowship of the Ring film. I could see that happening or working in some sense. But yeah, no, it is, you know, it would create, though again, you know, remember at the beginning of the Fellowship of the Ring, one of the initial frameworks, of course, is that Frodo already knows Gandalf quite well. So, again, it certainly does open the possibility that Gandalf is hanging out with them and that he could contribute to that conversation directly. So that would be one way. Bilbo could either say he'd heard it from Gandalf, or Gandalf could actually be present, and we could have like the three of them over tea. And see, and this is another way that you could use the frame narrative comparatively unintrusively. That is, it could be used even as a transitional approach. You know, when we're shifting from Bilbo's story of in fact, this would be a really cool thing. If we did have the frame narrative, including, you know, Elijah Wood, Ian Holm, and Ian McKellen sitting around the bag end table having tea or smoking out on the lawn together. If we did have that, then it would enable not only transitions between segments, that is Bilbo telling the story about, you know, the trolls, or telling the story about being captured by goblins in the Misty Mountains, and then Gandalf and taking over and being like, well, you know, I was late for the troll thing because this is what I was doing, you know, and then we get, you know, Gandalf's story of, you know, how he was meeting with, I don't know if he's going to run into Rivendell people or how they're going to handle that. But anyway, so you could easily see, you know, Gandalf jumping in now to fill in his part of the story and then going back to Bilbo. And the cool thing is that that could be done in such a way as to enable the kinds of shifts in tone that seem to be at least possible in the film. I'm not confident that they're going to do this, but remember, one of the questions all along was, how are you going to combine the, you know, the epic scope of, you know, a fitting follow-up to the Lord of the Rings films with the lighthearted, whimsical tone of the Hobbit book? And of course, one way to do that would be to have Bilbo's narration parts be lighter in mood and Gandalf's be more serious. I mean, if you actually establish through the frame that there are different voices, that there are different tellers of those two stories, you actually could play on that tonally and have the representations be a little bit different. I get that may be more complicated than they would actually do, but I think it would be cool.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. I don't know. I have a feeling that that could end up not working terribly well. Like, I feel like the effect on the film would be comedic, could potentially be comedic.
Yeah, yeah. Which, you know, I'd be cool with. But yeah,
I'm thinking of what my previously girlfriend, now fiance, Teresa would say.
Stumbling over that. Congratulations.
Yes, thank you very much.
She is officially a new thing now to you, so that is very exciting.
Yes, that's right. It is very exciting, although now we've just launched into the actual planning of the wedding, and that's not exciting.
Yes, no, that's somewhat sober, really.
Yes. but anyway, I have a feeling she wouldn't be terribly impressed with scenes with dueling tones. Like, here's a fun, lighthearted scene, and here's a really, really horrific, scary scene with Gandalf. And now we're back to the lighthearted scene, and now a scary scene.
Yeah, no, I mean, certainly if it were done in the really sort of clumsy way I just described it, it would just end up being awkward. But see how that could also lead to like different versions or different views of the same scene.
This recalls to me the comment somebody made on an episode a long time ago where they basically said, rather than splitting the films chronologically, why don't they just make two different films that tell parallel storylines from start to finish?
Right.
Right. Right. Exactly. But you, right. And I mean, clearly they're not going to actually do that. But yeah, so like my,
that's kind of a cool idea though.
My multiple narrator theory is that you essentially have those, parallel stories being told at the same time. And when the important thing is the emphasis on story, that's the thing that I think you get from a frame narrative, which can either be, used a lot and brought back to a lot, or we as the audience can be allowed to forget about it. But the it in question is the fact that it's a story that we're listening to. The fact that it's, we're not just, you know, we are not just kind of voyeurs in the film as we usually are. I mean, you know, normally when we watch a film, it's just like the fiction of the thing that we're watching. You know, the assumed and unmentioned fiction is that somehow we're just being enabled to see this, that like we have some kind of magical window into what's going on in this story, and no attention is ever drawn to the fact that somehow all of this is captured on film and we're sitting here seeing it. Now, I mean, that's perfectly acceptable as part of the sort of framework of assumptions that we bring to a film, but that's why I really enjoy films and plays and stories that actually draw attention to that. And Tolkien loved this. Tolkien very rarely just wrote books where he is asking the reader simply to make that kind of assumption about how you got the narrative that you are holding in your hands right now. Who wrote it down and how did they know all this stuff?
Right.
You know, and so he loved coming up with answers to those questions and showing us how that works. And I really like that kind of story. Like, this is one of the things, you know, one of my favorite books is Dracula by Bram Stoker. It's a fantastic novel. And it's one of the things that happens in that novel too, is that we see the actual narrative of the story being written as the story goes along. You know, the first-hand documents that are being recorded, people's diaries and stuff, and we see them being gathered together. And there's a part of the book when they're actually carrying around a wad of manuscript, which is going to be the book eventually. Tolkien never does that quite to that extent, to actually have like, you know, the book or the scroll of the Lord of the Rings, being carried around. But anyway, a kind of a film version of that is kind of cool. And you invoke that possibility whenever you have this kind of a frame story. You're drawing attention to the fact that it's a story being told and inviting the reader to think about things like point of view and, you know, who's telling the story and how do they know all they know and who's the audience for the story and what's going on. So this is why, as I said way back at the beginning, as soon as I heard that Elijah Wood had been cast, I was ecstatic because I was assuming, and it turned out rightly, it seems, that what that meant was that we were going to do this kind of a frame narrative. We were going to get our attention was going to be drawn to the status of the Hobbit story as a story within the Lord of the Rings world, and that story was going to have a teller, which was almost certainly going to be Bilbo.
Right.
So awesome. Or even, I mean, I think the first thing I pictured when I heard about Elijah Wood was actually getting post Lord of the Rings views of Frodo as editor, essentially. And him doing the collation of Bilbo's private diary on the one hand and accounts and stuff from Gandalf on the other hand. Now, having it be Bilbo and Frodo sitting around prior to the Lord of the Rings talking about it doubtless will work better on film than Frodo as later in his life editor would work. But anyway, it opens up lots of opportunities. So to me, the biggest question is, how much are they going to seek to take advantage of these kinds of opportunities? How big a deal is the frame going to be?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that is the big question. Are they just going to tee it up and hit it and then we're done? And maybe we'll see him again at the end of the film or the beginning of the next film. Basically, the role that the intro played in Fellowship of the Ring and some of the other Lord of the Rings films, or are we going to keep revisiting it? I mean, I personally hope we revisit it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. I really hope, you know, not that it would necessarily interrupt the frame, though. Again, my on this part, you know, as as usual, it seems like almost every episode I like confess a private fantasy about what will happen in the film and then say it probably won't happen, but it would be awesome if it did. So here is my frame narrative equivalent of the burned dwarf reference that I'm holding out for. And that is, for there to be a narrative interruption during the Gollum sequence. That is at least a nod to the fact that Bilbo is tempted to tell the wrong version of the story. And so for there to be a frame interruption, to go back to Ian Holm and Elijah Wood, and I keep mentioning the actors' names, of course, to clarify young Bilbo and old Bilbo. Right. But like, yeah, to shift back from Martin Freeman to Ian Holm in the middle of the Gollum sequence and then have like a correction. Not necessarily redoing a scene, but at least being reminded, or given some kind of a glimpse that there's some kind of, that Bilbo is being tempted. And even maybe Frodo being kind of puzzled, but passing it off or something. Anyway, that would be, I would love to see that. I doubt it will happen, but I would love to see it.
Do you think that's likely?
No, I don't think it's, impossible, but I don't think it's likely. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. We should probably get towards our prediction here.
Yep. Yep, we probably should
today, but I do have to go pick up my son. So,
All right.
I still have an end cap commitment that drives me away from the microphone here. So, but anyway, let's talk about our prediction. Our prediction is about, it's in connection with the frame narrative. We were thinking about the opening sequence of the film. So how are they going to do the opening sequence? So the four options that we had were, first, it will be a sort of voiceover flashback, a like exposition of background material. In some sense, kind of, I mean, that's how the Fellowship of the Ring, so of course, with Galadriel's thing at the beginning of the Fellowship of the Ring, that's sort of the classic illustration of this mode. Whether they're talking about the history of the dwarves or like, you know, there are a bunch of things that could be done. We could get maybe a few brief glimpses of something that might or might not be the Battle of Azanul Bazar, whatever. there would be an opportunity. There'd be an opportunity. Anyway, never mind. I'll stop fantasizing and continue describing the options. So option A is some kind of voiceover exposition-based narration of past events.
Yeah.
Option B.
Basically, Fellowship a la Galadriel voiceover in Fellowship
right,
of the Ring.
Right. Like that, but obviously something else. Option B is a flashback without voiceover. So basically, option B and C are both flashbacks without voiceover. Option B is flashback type one, namely an epic action sequence. And actually the Two Towers was an illustration with this, starting off the opening sequence of the Two Towers with Gandalf fighting the Balrog as they plummet down into the depths of Khazad Dûm. That is that would count as an option B flashback epic battle sequence. Starting off with a little Battle of Azanul Bazar would count. Starting off with Smaug attacking, a Smaug who is probably not fully seen on screen. But anyway, starting off with dwarves running in panic while the fire rages in the city of Dale, that would count as option B. Option C is flashback type two, which means that is like a non-action sequence. So actually the Return of the King, starting with the flashback to Sméagol and Diagol, that would be an option C opening.
What do you think that would look like for The Hobbit? I mean, it's easy to see what the first two might be. The first one might be, Thorin Oakenshield narrating the events of the Battle of Azanul Bazar. The second one might be just a scene of Smaug attacking the Lonely Mountain without anyone actually narrating what's happening. Mm-hmm. What do you think C might look like? Gandalf and Thorin meeting at the Green Dragon.
Bree.
The Green Dragon, and Bree at the Prancing Pony.
That would certainly be one option. Another option would be Gandalf meeting Bilbo, imitating the opening of the Hobbit book, having Bilbo smoking out on the lawn and, you know, Gandalf walking up the hill and saying good morning. That would be another option. The opening scene take place, you know, something I could imagine the opening scene taking, though I'm thinking of it off the top of my head, in the halls of Thorin out in the Blue Mountains, right? Sort of seeing the dwarves, starting with Dwarves in Exile, and learning the story behind that later. I could imagine that. It has to be sort of flashback. Now, this is the tricky thing, is that how are they going to integrate this with the frame narrative? Okay, I should finish the options. Option D is starting with the frame narrative. That is, the opening sequence after the credits roll is Ian Holm and Elijah Wood, and perhaps Ian McKellen also. That it takes place in the chronological moment of the frame narrative, namely well post Hobbit, you know, decades post Hobbit action, but prior to the beginning of the Lord of the Rings, post Hobbit, long expected party. If it starts in that time sequence with Gandalf and or, Bilbo and Frodo, that would be option D. Of course, another option for B could be, that is, for the action sequence opening, could be the one that I still secretly pine for in my heart of hearts, the sort of James Bond-esque Gandalf and Dol Guldur opening. Would love that. Love that. Though not one that ends with a car chase, so in that way, unlike a James Bond opening, but yes, would love to see, like,
I don't know, you know, if Radagast showed up with his bunny-pulled sleigh.
Right, we can high-speed bunny-pulled sleigh race.
Yeah. He'd be chased down by ring raids.
Yeah. hopefully not. But anyway, I guess it would be no more absurd than like a hovercraft chase or a gondola chase or something like that, as has happened in other Bond films. But that would be another. I would still count that as an action sequence, unless we have in fact just Gandalf meeting Thrain at Dol Guldur. I would count that as C. You know, again, if it's not either a chase scene or a fight scene, then it doesn't count as B.
We're gonna have trouble differentiating these.
No, but see, the fortunate thing is that we can always just fall back on completely arbitrary declarations. So I'm happy about that anyway.
That's true.
So, we will see. We will, of course, try to be very consistent and democratic. But then at some point, we will just say what it is and invite everybody to yell at us. So those are our four options. Voiceover exposition, the flashback epic action sequence, the flashback non-action sequence, and the frame narrative with Bilbo and Frodo.
Yep. Okay. So, in that case, what are you going to pick? Or shall I go first?
I describe the option, so you go first.
All right, I'll go first. Boy, I'll tell you what, I'm really torn between, and my choice here is going to be largely driven by what I hope they do, not by what I think it's likely they'll do. Or rather, what I think makes more sense. I'm really torn between, the desire for them to really, really consistently stick with the frame story, which means not introducing things outside the frame story. Like, I think it would break the frame if we start off with a 5-minute narrated, you know, here's a bunch of stuff that happened in the past type thing, where it's kind of, it's, that's happening outside the frame. I'm sort of hoping, there's part of me that hopes that if they show us glimpses of battle as a Nolbazar, it happens within the frame of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm not saying I definitely want a battle as a Nolbazar, part. In fact, my secret hope is that they're going to film like a 45-minute Battle of Azanulbazar sequence and just include it in the extra materials.
We have a separate DVD just for the Battle of Azanulbazar.
That's right. Yeah, that's my hope.
All right. Yeah. Hey, as long as we're hoping, why not?
Or just make it a separate movie.
Yes. The Hobbit Part 3, The Battle of Azanulbazar. The prequel to the prequel. There you go.
That's right. So anyway, I definitely want to see that, but I think it will be weird if we go from a narrated sequence or an unnarrated sequence that happens outside the frame, and then we go to Bilbo and Frodo, and then we go into the story that Bilbo's telling to Frodo. I think that could end up getting really disorienting and confusing and weird. Okay. I found it weird the way it was done. The Galadriel opening, I thought, was kind of strange, because it's like, who's telling me this story? But anyway, so
right.
On the other hand, I really do think that that would be a great way to start the movie off with a bang, starting with one of those battles. So I'm torn, but I'm going to go with D. I want to begin with the frame story. I want them to be consistent and use that frame story.
Yep. Well, I am sorry to say I agree with you. I'm going with D too.
Oh, well, that's no fun.
I know. But see, yeah, because basically I think they're going to get, if we were to start with a flashback, the chronology gets really messed up. I mean, say we start with, you know, Dale on fire and dwarves running around screaming with their hands up in the air. Like maybe a female dwarf shown, you know, I don't know. But anyway, if we were to start with that, then what? Then we jump forward 60 years and then jump back to a time that's later than that, at an indefinite amount of time different from the opening sequence. It would get really complicated pretty fast, I think. Mm-hmm. So I think that if we're gonna do the frame anyway, one set of chronology jumping, from frame to story and back to frame to story, that's enough, I think. And anything more than that is gonna muddy the waters. So for that reason, my guess would be the opening thing we will open the film at Bag End. And we'll get Bilbo and Frodo and maybe Gandalf. So that, yes, that is also my prediction for that reason too. But we'll see. Though again, I am not without hope that we will get, like Gandalf sneaking through the halls of Dol Guldur with like some awesome, like Mission Impossible music in the background. Like, I still do kind of hold out, fantasies of that, but we'll see. We'll see. I don't have enough hope that that's going to happen actually to predict it.
All right. Well, it's kind of, it's in a way, it's comforting when we pick the same one, because it makes it likely that we're probably right. Well, maybe it doesn't. Maybe it actually doesn't improve our chances of being right at all.
Yeah, maybe not. But
yeah. Okay. Well, I guess we'll be interesting to see what our cohorts think and what the listeners think. Definitely encourage people to, once this episode's released, head over to the Mythgard page, go in the exclusive section to the Riddles in the Dark part, and after you listen to this episode, give us your comments and let us know how you think that the unexpected journey will begin. And if you haven't had a chance, there seem to be fewer than usual comments on episode 6 and 7, which I suspect may be due to the fact that for some reason people can't seem to find them on iTunes.
That's really weird. I'll have to look into that again.
Yeah, I'll try to.
Because they're there when I downloaded them. I mean,
me too.
My iTunes shows them up, so I'm not quite sure what's happening there.
Maybe what I'll do is edit the RSS feed file, make like one trivial change so it refreshes.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see. Because I'm not sure about that. Also, I mean, it was released within like a day of episode 8, so it may well just be also true. That people are commenting more on the more recent one.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah.
But
and
definitely, I encourage people to go ahead and comment on things when you've listened to them. If you haven't commented on episodes 6 through 8, go for it. We will definitely address your feedback on upcoming episodes as well as not to mention this one as well. We really want to hear what you think about the split, the White Council storyline, the ring wraiths, and now on our handling of the frame narrative and on the how the film will begin. So
that's right. And hopefully as we now move into summertime, I hope we'll get the chance to include a clearer mechanism for fan voting on options as well.
Yes, me too. I'm really excited about doing something like that, adding some kind of poll or something.
Yes.
So we will work on that, we promise. And in the meantime, yeah, go comment on the Mythgard page, comment on the Tolkien Professor or Mythgard Facebook pages if you would like. Send messages to us on Twitter, at Tolkien Prof and at Dave Kale. Use the pound Riddles in the Dark hashtag. And we're really looking forward to hearing what people think.
Yep, that's right.
All right, Corey, why don't you take us away, since the last few weeks you haven't been able to because you had to run
that's
off to teach lecture.
That's true. Yes, the last few weeks have featured, like, my disappearing footsteps as I sprint across campus to teach class. But anyway, yes. Well, thanks for joining us, everybody. Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.